Welcome to This Is Money. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And the rich are getting richer, and the poor, well, they're getting richer too, though not by as much. What's it down to, and is inequality really on the rise? No get-rich-quick schemes here. Slow and steady wins the race. We take a look at Vanguard's move on the UK pensions scene. We answer a reader's question about retiring in their 50s, but they've only £6,000 in their pension pot. Also stamp collections, inheritance tax and premium bond millionaires. And don't forget, you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, we had figures out this week that showed the rich are getting richer, but so too is everyone else, just not quite by as much. Now, the ONS says the combined wealth of British households has risen over the past decade. It's up 13% between 2014 and 2018 alone. Now, that's despite stagnating incomes. But the richest 10%, who hold 45% of the UK's wealth, grew almost four times as fast between 2016 and 2018 than the poorest 10%. Very good morning, Lee.
Morning.
Why is that?
Well, this is a...
We're getting richer. That's great news, isn't it?
Well, it is and it isn't. So this is an annual report from the Office for National Statistics, which looks at basically household wealth, across the country. So what that means, so let's strip this right back and explain what that means. So it is the value of property owned minus mortgages, and then includes things such as cash and savings accounts, investments, stocks and shares, ISAs, minus any debt, and also things like pension pots and physical items like cars, antiques and artwork, which of course for the upper echelons, I'm sure that is more applicable to us plebs down here that don't have those kind of investments. What's happened with these figures and what it's shown over the last couple of years, a lot of people, you know, this country, we're obsessed with house prices and property prices, and there has been some of that growth has been from property prices. They're going along steadily, I would say more so. But you think this is looking at 2016 to 2018, especially around about 2016-17, there was quite a lot more house price growth than there has been arguably in the last 18 months, 24 months. So there was a little bit of that at play. But what actually these figures show is that people are putting more money into pensions. The pension pots are swelling. People are actually...
Is that auto-enrolment got a part to play, do you think?
I would suggest so. I reckon that has quite a big part to play in it. The average net wealth has gone up £25,000, according to this research, roughly. I think quite a bit of that can be contributed to people actually, as you say, being enrolled into paying pensions without having to do too much thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot more people are actually just taking perhaps a little bit more of an interest and realising that state pension perhaps isn't going to be the great shining light at our retirement years, as recent cases and things have shown. So I think more people are sort of taking control of their finances. I'd like to think a little bit, this research shows. But of course, as you pointed out, the richest 10% I've seen their wealth grow four times as fast as the poorest 10%. That kind of thing is absolute, you know, dynamite for someone like the Labour Party and Jeremy Corbyn, in which they are saying for the many, not the few. We've obviously got the general election coming up next week, and this kind of thing adds fuel to the fire, doesn't it? And what that will be down to, again, it's what we've just touched on, you know, property prices, people that are lucky enough, fortunate enough to own their home. A lot of people now, increasing number of people are becoming mortgage free, mm-hmm. where they're paying off their homes. So they've had a home for maybe 20, 30 years. They've seen that house price go rocket. And now they've paid off their mortgage, so they own that asset outright. There's been quite a lot of that. And then we can look at that. You can drill down to the real regional discrepancies here as well. So, you know, London and the South East, of course, much more, higher net wealth than those northern areas. And again, and part of that also will be to do with pension savings as well, because in London and the South East, you're probably arguably saying that people's wages are higher, cost of living is higher, but people are probably funneling more money away than they are in other parts of the country. And when you are in the poorest 10%, it's very hard to get out of that poorest 10%.
An interesting point that Lee makes there, because I was thinking about this. The Resolution Foundation have got involved. They were the ones that pointed out how the UK's richest grew at almost four times as fast as the poorest 10%. And I thought, leading up to an election, I know the ONS is obviously neutral and these are just stats and figures, etc. But surely that would play into the hands of Jeremy Corbyn. But actually reading a little bit more into this, has inequality in the UK grown as fast as perhaps perception would believe? And the reason I come to you on this, Simon, is because isn't there something called the Gini coefficient, which I love because you mention it quite a lot of times in the past?
Yes, and actually on that measure, Britain...
What is that, apart from, the Gini coefficient, rubber lamp or something?
It is a measure of inequality, where 100 would be perfect inequality and zero would be perfect equality. So it's if all of that those assets were shared out. Mm-hmm. The income was shared out. It allows you to measure it. Now, the interesting thing is, if you look at the Gini coefficient, Britain has actually become a more equal country, both in terms of wealth, which is what we're talking about here, and also when you look at statistics for income. So when you hear the suggestion that inequality is growing, the gap between the richest and the poorest is getting wider, it's not statistically proven. There is plenty of other data points that you can look at that illustrates that, yes, it is. So, for example, there is the scenario where that Gini coefficient hasn't gone up, but the Resolution Foundation said that even if relative wealth inequality has stayed still, the gap in absolute terms between the richest and the poorest household deciles, so the top 10% and the bottom 10%, has widened over the past decade from 1.9 million to 2.5 million. And actually, there were some very interesting statistics mm-hmm. done on income instead of wealth. And this is the problem we face nowadays, actually, just before I say that, is that do we measure income? Do we measure wealth? Now, income has always traditionally been seen as typically a good measure because that's how much money people have got coming in. But those with sizable wealth could have a relatively small income. They can just live off of their wealth. And because of two decades of house price inflation, you know, post 1997, that have seen property prices go up, but a lot more in some parts of the country than others, and particularly a lot more at the top end of the property market. And obviously, if a large number goes up by a certain percentage compared to a small number, well, that large number goes up to a much, much larger number. And also because of how people's wealth is largely held in pensions and that goes up, that means that there's this magnifying effect with the wealth scenario. So, but to go back to what I was going to say about the income, there was some good work done by the IFS earlier this year, which drilled deeper into it. So instead of going into the top decile, it looked at the 1%. Who are the 1%? But then it looked at the 0.1%. And that's where you really, really, really start to see the big disparities. So to go back to your question, and the reason why you asked it, yes, actually, if you want to take those headlines and stand up and make your big tub-thumping speeches, mm-hmm. then you can find plenty of examples of very, very rich people making tons and tons of money for whom the conditions of the past decade since the financial crisis have been extremely favourable. Low interest rates, cheap money, blows up the value of assets. If you've got assets, you're doing really well. But if you don't have assets and you're just an ordinary working Joe in a deprived area, incomes have fallen in real terms, so you're doing worse. So your income is falling behind inflation and you've got even less chance of buying those assets. So whilst you've got the statistics that show we are becoming more equal, or at least flatlining, we're not becoming more unequal, you can easily find lots of anecdotal bits of evidence that shows that this family in the northeast, where things have been pretty depressed and house prices are still below where they were at the peak of the property boom in 2007, compared to Johnny Banker on you in his nice big house in Notting Hill, who basically that was maybe worth 2 million back then and now it's worth 7 million, that there's a big gap.
How then, if we do think this is a problem that perhaps... I keep thinking Johnny Banker and I want to call him Tarquin Banker or something a bit more, you know. If we do want to close the gap, or if we do think it's getting bigger and that sort of thing, how do we go about doing it, Lee, when And I keep thinking back to that gentleman on Question Time who was earning 80 grand. Do you remember him?
I do, yes.
What do we define as rich? Because if you're earning 26 or 27, which is the national average, but you've got no mortgage, et cetera, you have no dependents, or you're 80,000. I found myself defending this guy on 80,000. I think everyone thought that's what I was paid. I'm not. But, you know, if he's got a business to run, or you know, six kids, or two wives, do you know what I mean?
Just to jump in very quickly there and go back to what I said about the IFS research, which was into income, and that's what we're talking about here, income. £80,000 man, it very much depends where he lives. Mm. And one of the things that IFS research looked at was not just across nationwide, who is the 1%, who is the top 10%, who is the top 5%, but also geographically. And the gap between what you would need to be in the top 10% in the UK and then the top 10% in London, for example, is astonishing.
Yeah.
So it very much depends where you live. And then to reflect on what you're going to say, it also depends on the makeup of your household. Because if you're a single earner on £80,000 and you don't have another working member of the household, clearly you're not going to be as wealthy mm-hmm. as if you've got two earners on £80,000.
Precisely. So in that regard then, Lee, a bit like house prices and initiatives by governments to make it fair for first-time buyers to get on the housing ladder, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. When it's so regionally different and with so blended families and so confusing, then how do you define what is rich? How do you perhaps solve a problem that may be there in some parts but not others more?
Thinking about that £80,000 man, I do think that when you, if you're lucky enough to see your earnings potential grow over the years, it seems to be that doesn't mean necessarily that you have more money. I know that sounds really strange, but as in other bills start to grow, things start to happen, and it's almost like that wealth keeps on in it. The more money you've got, the more money you spend kind of thing. So it's kind of like, I can kind of understand where he's coming from, but it's very hard to have sympathy because for the majority of people, £80,000 a year job sounds like, you know, absolutely fantastic wage. And it is a fantastic wage, almost four times the national average. So of course, I think if we're talking about how we spread some more, you know, make it more of a balanced playing field across the country, I just think simply there are pockets of the country that just need way more infrastructure. They need jobs moving there. There needs to be a bit more of a spread around. Let's face it, there are far too many jobs in London. There are. London is just the hub. It is the capital. And there are millions of people that are even just commuting into London from the outskirts for hours away to get in to work in London. And, you know, the only way I could reasonably say and suggest perhaps that, you know, some areas would see potential growth is if you start moving. And there has been a bit of that. I mean, you could argue that, you know, someone like the BBC going to Manchester, for example, Channel 4 is going to Leeds. It's very media orientated examples. But there will be other examples that, you know, jobs have been created in areas. But, you know, a lot of it here, a lot of it in London and the South East is just linked to property prices, and property prices are linked to the wages because the wages are higher than they are elsewhere in the country. And actually, the ONS figures show that only the North East and the East Midlands are the regions that are yet to see their wealth rise above levels seen between July 2006 and July 2008. So that's a decade in which, you know, their household wealth hasn't grown whatsoever. And a lot of that will just be down to those kind of things and regional discrepancies. But can I bring it back just quickly?
Yeah.
Because the thing I took away from this that I thought was really interesting was the stuff around pensions. And actually, the fact that private pension pots now comprise of 42% of our household wealth, that is a huge number when you think only a decade earlier it was 34%. And now there's £6.1 trillion tied up in private pensions. A decade earlier, £3.6 trillion. What that says to me is, firstly, good on people for, you know, saving perhaps a bit harder for their retirement, but also the scope for another financial crisis, for example, with a lot of private pensions tied up in stock markets, et cetera, that gets quite spicy if there's another, you know.
It's a word for it, Lee.
It is, because, you know, if there's a big downturn and people don't realise what their pensions are invested in, you know, that could be a recipe for all sorts of disaster. But 42%, and actually it's outstripped house growth, so it's actually 35% is how much a property makes up of household wealth. So it's quite a big gap emerging between pensions and housing.
Is what you're saying, 1 second, is what you're saying then, Lee, after 5 years of telling everyone to get a pension, just stick it under your bed, yeah?
No, because it's long term, and you ride out any potential. But I'm just thinking about certain newspaper headlines in which they say, billions wiped off of pensions. Yeah. Where, of course, there's
it's
never
not billion, a laughing matter.
Billions wiped onto pensions. Yeah, so I mean, it's just food for thought, Georgie.
There's also some very interesting stuff here, if you think about policy and public policy, right? So, the national average net household wealth is £286,600. Then that ranges around the country from 172,900 in the northeast to 445,900 in the southeast, which actually outstrips London, which is 356,400, which I think is an interesting reflection on what Lee was saying about pensions there, and also wealth held outside of pensions, because actually you would expect London to be highest because that's where property prices are highest, but actually you've got those people with the big pension pots who are living in the commuter belt. But what's really interesting when you look at it is you've got pensions, property, and then you've also got net household wealth, so savings, investments, the stuff that's held outside of a pension or a property. Now, when we hear talk about inheritance tax and the need to either raise or lower the threshold, the Tories promised to make it 1 million. They used this own home allowance to get it up there rather than just make it 1 million. Labour have said they'll bring it back down to 650,000. There's even been talk of this lifetime gift tax that was floated in a Labour-linked think tank, where basically everybody would be allowed to get 125,000 per person given to them, and above that they would pay tax at marginal rates. Now, that would see the average two-child family left money by their parents definitely paying 40% tax on some of the money, okay? Whereas at the moment, the average two-child family left everything by their parents would not pay any inheritance tax whatsoever. But this element where a lot of what's talked about as what justifies taxing inheritance much harder is that this is not double-taxed money, because people go, well, it's double tax. I pay tax on it when I earn the money, and then I've saved it up and I've been prudent all my life, and then you're going to tax it when I die. That is outrageous. And people say, well, it's not that. It's house price inflation. You've just benefited from house price inflation. That's what makes up most of people's wealth. But it's not, is it? That's not what the statistics bear out. Now, a pension is potentially free of inheritance tax if you pass it on, depending on what type of pension it is. If it's a defined contribution pension that's invested, you die before the age of 70, it's free of inheritance tax. If you leave it after the age of 70, then it does incur a tax bill. The beneficiary pays tax of their income rate on it. But the money outside of that, the bit that's not the pension, the bit that's not the property, that isn't something that's only there because of house price inflation. That's not something that's protected by the fact that pensions protect you slightly better against inheritance tax nowadays. That genuinely is money that people have earned and pay tax on and saved up or invested through their whole lives. And so if you do suddenly dramatically lower what people can leave down to that 125,000 per person level, and that's money you get rather than money you give, then you will start to be falling into that you're double taxing me argument. And that's where things start to get tricky. Then you also have, there is a push for a wealth tax. You know, there are large chunks of the more left-leaning, redistributive side of the economic argument who say we should have a wealth tax. Now, one of the arguments against that is that there are very few countries in the world that have a wealth tax where it's actually worked. And a lot of the countries that had them have actually axed them. But you can see why reports like this make people go, we need a wealth tax. We need to get those people. But one of the interesting things is actually if you look at it over the 10 years of the Tory government, they have actually hit the people at the top quite hard in terms of tax. You are very much limited as to what you can put into your pension nowadays. There is the lifetime allowance, which is just over £1 million. That's much lower than it used to be, and there didn't used to be one at all. There is the annual allowance of £40,000. If you're a high earner, that goes down to as little as £10,000, which is causing a crisis in the NHS. There is the bit which we talked about last week where they take people's personal allowance off them over £100,000, so they end up paying 60% tax. There's the bit where child benefit has been taken off people. There's the bit where there are what are described by many people as punitive stamp duty rates at the top end of the housing market. So actually quite a lot of stuff has been done to go after this sort of top strata of society here. Whereas some of the argument about the tax burden being talked about is that the tax burden now falls much tighter onto the highest income people rather than being spread across broader society. And that was one of the criticisms the IFS gave of the Labour plans the other day. So yeah, to go back to what you said earlier on in the podcast, there is actually a lot of stuff that when you dig into it doesn't bear out with this whole we're going really easy on the rich and they're just getting richer and we're becoming more unequal. Having said that, when I walk down the road and I see lots of homeless people lying there and I'm off to my comfortable job in an office or off to my comfortable home and I don't have to worry about that stuff, that disturbs me.
Yeah, passing the posh cars that you do where you work as well in Kensington is, I mean, look, the narratives write themselves. We're going to move on, but Lee, I'm going to bring you back to retirement, if that's all right. As you mentioned it a little bit earlier, and we're going to move on specifically to pensions. And one of the questions that you get asked a lot is how much can you retire on for a comfortable retirement, etc. But this person who's emailed into you is in their 50s. They have not so sizable £6,000 pension pot. Don't worry, they are not completely deluded as far as I know. but let me just read this out to you. This is the email. I'm a 58-year-old, looking to retire as soon as possible. I'm mortgage and debt-free, but only have around £6,000 in my company pension. I had an £84,000 pension pot, but cashed it in when I was 55 to pay off debts. I ended up with £63,000 after paying tax on it. Since then, I've come into an inheritance, so I now have around £420,000 in a bank saving account and have rejoined my company's pension scheme. Is there any way I can use, save, invest, or top up my pension to get me a monthly income of around £1,500 to £2,000 a month so I can retire?
This question, Georgie, has been immensely popular this week on our website. There has been a surge of traffic and people having a look at this and having a read of this, suggesting that perhaps, you know, obviously it's a very specific case and we're talking about very specific figures, but people may be in a similar boat, especially when it comes to, you know, receiving a chunk of money in inheritance and wondering if perhaps that can help them retire early. So this reader in question is 58. They are sort of 9 years off, roughly. We don't know a specific date of birth, but probably about 9 years off a retirement age, so the age in which they'd get state pension. And interestingly, they cashed out that pension when they were 55 to pay off debts. Whether that was a wise move or not, however, according to our expert, is open for debate, which I will explain. So basically, if they hadn't attacked that pension, hadn't sort of raided that pension pot, the potential is they could have started salting more money away into it instead of now being able only to put in a maximum of £4,000 a year, which is under rules. If you take out, you know, your pension at the age of 55, you can't start, you know, maxing out £40,000 a year into a pension. So for that reason, perhaps it wasn't the wisest move. But however, we don't have all the ins and outs, and I don't know what kind of debts we're talking about. And, you know, must have been, you'd like to think it must have been fairly serious if they've paid £21,000 of tax to access that money. That's a large hit, isn't it? I suspect that they knew the inheritance was coming at some point. But it's an interesting question because I always think this, like if you win £1 million in the lottery, for example, and you think, oh, well, you know, you read people, oh, I'm going to retire now, that's great. And actually, depending on your age, £1 million, in the grand scheme of things, if you're thinking that's going to be a silver bullet for you to never work again, well, perhaps. But it's very difficult in, you know, where we're at the moment to get a steady, absolute guaranteed cast iron return on your money that's going to return you £1,500 to £2,000 a month, a livable amount of money. So it's and
as we just said, a financial crisis, and we're all
exactly.
Screwed.
And you know, this person's 58. I mean, the likelihood is they're going to be alive. It's hard, it's always hard, isn't it, to sort of completely know, but could be alive for a year, but could be alive for 20, 30, 40
of
years.
Course.
So it's a long old time in which, when you start dividing that money up and thinking about how much money they've got divided by the number of years they might potentially live for, it's actually not an awful, awful sum of money. So anyway, we asked an expert. The first thing he said was to check your state pension. So to basically make sure that you've paid in enough NI over the years and that you're going to get a full state pension, and you can kind of tap that into, and obviously, any of your retirement planning. So at the moment, obviously, maximum state pension is £168.60 a week. By the time they reach retirement age, it's going to have grown a triple lock. Potentially, if the triple lock survives, which looking likely it's going to for another government. So want to sort of crunch the sums, make sure that you're putting that in there. And then he's saying to plan ahead if you want to keep your inheritance in cash. Now, what he means by that is if you just put it into a run-of-the-mill savings account, first of all, you're kind of in danger of falling foul of the financial services compensation scheme rules, where you can only be protected up to £85,000 per banking licence. So you ideally, if you're going to want to do that, split your cash up, because it could be at risk. I mean, you know, you'd like to think the likelihood of a big bank going under is slim, but hey, we live through the financial crisis, so we know anything is possible. So it's worth splitting your money up if you're going to do that. But however, your return on that as a lump sum of £420,000 is going to be way more than it would be if you split it up, if you see what I mean. So,
yeah.
And the interest rate that you're going to get on it is in a savings account, I mean, we're talking top rate easy access at the moment of 1.45%, and even those rates are in danger. So that's quite difficult. And then he's saying, consider if you want to invest your inheritance. Well, that's probably, you know, the wisest bit of advice, but of course, again, you don't have a guaranteed income from that. You don't know, it could vary from one time to the next. And as we always say, you know, investing for the long term. I'm not sure investing is really for sort of drip feeding, you know, as in like drip feeding cash out of it for a monthly solid income. I think it's quite, I don't know, it can be done. I'm sure Simon might disagree with me on this and might add his penny of thoughts there. And the last thing is to consider buying an annuity, which have had a kind of weird bad rep, I would argue, in the last few years, but it is worth finding out. But I would say overall, the most important thing in my opinion is to get some proper financial advice. Financial advisor, a good one, a reputable one, is worth the weight in gold for a situation like this, in my opinion. You know, unless you are very, very confident in investing and really, really know what you're doing, I think the outlay potentially of getting some financial advice could be worth it in this circumstance.
Penny, for your thoughts, Simon, on that?
Well, this is not financial advice, but I tell you what I'd do with the money. I would put the money into a portfolio of investment trusts, income investment trusts. We had an article earlier this week written by Jeff Prestridge, which explained the idea behind doing this. It had a portfolio of 10 income-based investment trusts. They pay out dividends, and what you could do is you can invest the money into that portfolio so it's spread around. Investment trusts are able to protect their dividends by keeping over some money in the good times in order to help pay out the dividends in the bad times, and you can screen those investment trusts to try to find the ones that are best likely to be able to do that, that have the highest level of reserves, the longest record of paying out dividends without cutting them. And you could average in that portfolio that Jeff wrote about a dividend income of 4.4%. Now at 4%, that would get you £16,1800 a year. Doesn't sound like a huge amount based on your £420,000 that you've invested, but you could decide to spend some of that £420,000 every year. What you need to be aware of is that if you spend that money, then obviously the dividend income is going to decline slightly. But what that also doesn't allow for is for them going up in value. Now, you could find that your portfolio doesn't just pay out a 4.4% a year income return, that it also gains a bit each year. And in fact, if you look back at that portfolio, that's what it's done. So you could maybe hope for maybe 2 to 3% a year on average in gains. And so you would probably see yourself right. The difficulty would be that you're going to have to pay tax on it. You do have to pay tax on dividends. Under a Labour government, you'd have to pay considerably more tax on dividends. But what you want to do is start trying to get some of that money into an ISA, because you can put £20,000 a year into an ISA. So you want to start drip feeding it into an ISA, be that in cash, be that in the investments I was talking about, so that ultimately, over a period of time, you are getting as much of it into a scenario where the money you take from it is tax-free.
OK, Simon, I want to stick with investing because we've got a couple of stories I just want to run by you. The first one being Vanguard. Great name, but you're always thinking, why have they been so slow to come over here? You'd expect with a... Never mind. 2.5 years ago, they launched the DIY investing platform. Don't laugh at me, Simon.
It took me a while to get your terrible joke.
It's not a joke. Genuinely, that's how my brain works. You think it should be at the Vanguard or something, right? It should have been here ages ago.
Maybe Greta was
And that's
it.
Going to be one of my questions is, why is it not? Why is it now? Because it's now entered the UK pension scene. With a pensions platform. But, you know, why have they been so slow? It's a big name.
Well, Vanguard has been over here for some time, but what it's done is it's just offered its funds to people. So Vanguard is one of the world's largest fund managers.
Yeah.
It famously was started by a man called Jack Bogle, who recently died. And his idea was to offer people the opportunity not to pay large amounts of money to a fund manager who would then go out and try to pick the best companies and beat the market, but instead offer them the opportunity to just follow the market cheaply and simply with a tracker fund. And it has proved wildly popular. Vanguard's tracker funds have been on offer in the UK for a long time, but it also built up an investing platform in the US, and that's what it was quite slow to bring over here. It brought that 2 years ago. You could open an ISA, you could open a general investment account. It was launched to some fanfare because mm-hmm. the charges for using the platform are very, very low, 0.15% annual charge. To put that into context, that means that for every £1,000 you invest, you are paying £1.50 a year, which is pretty darn cheap when you think about what else you can get in the world for £1.50. And it's proved very popular. But the one thing they didn't offer was pensions. And they promised pensions when they launched, but they didn't arrive, they didn't arrive, mm-hmm. didn't arrive. Now those pensions have arrived, or will soon, imminently, arrive. And if you are looking for a very easy, very cheap place to build up a pension, I would say this is a very good place to be. I don't have a Vanguard account, just in case this sounds a bit too much like an advert for Vanguard, because I'm the kind of person who likes to pick lots of different funds and investment trusts and shares and things like that, whereas Vanguard only offers its own funds. And actually, in my column this week, I wrote about it. There are 76 funds mm-hmm. from Vanguard you could choose from to put in your pension. If you want that cheap, easy, simple pension, I'd ignore most of them. Don't even think about them. What you want is a fund that invests all around the world, puts your money into different assets. Vanguard's life strategy funds do that. They share your money between a different percentage in shares and bonds. You choose the one that equates to the risk level that you want to take. They charge you 0.22% a year. That's £2.20 on every £1,000 invested. Add it to your 0.15%. You're paying £3.70 a year for every £1,000 you've invested. Set it up, get the money going in monthly, and then just forget about it and allow the history of investing in companies that can put money to productive use to allow you to beat inflation and cash over time, and then one day thank your lucky stars that you bothered to do this a long, long time ago.
Lee, you've either got a nervous tick there or you're nodding along in agreement with Simon, because I've never seen you nod along so long. Which is like humming a tune.
I was feeling a bit smug because I opened a Vanguard account. And I don't know if you listened to Podcast Past when I was talking about saving for my young daughter. And actually, it's just a very easy way just to get started in investing, got stocks and shares ISA. And you could kind of, you know, just set it up and forget about it. And as Simon says, I mean, it's, you know, when you look at the fees that are involved, you know, it undercuts the competition or the majority of competition. And it's, you know, in my eyes, a very good product. And launching a SIP here, I have a friend who's a contractor. He earns pretty good money, but he doesn't have a private company pension, and has been looking, you know, into SIPs and options, and has got completely bogged down and confused by it all. And I just literally emailed him the link this week and said, just wait and open this in the new year, because this will be golden. And actually, in this story, I think there's a very interesting table in here, which is about the annual management charge. So 0.15%. if you're over 10 years, how much you'd get after costs is 98.51% of your investment. Whereas if you're at the upper end, 2.5%, okay, that is very expensive. I mean, it's very unlikely that you've probably got money tied up in those kind of... But it's not completely out of the ordinary. But 77.63%. But even like a little nudge up, so let's talk about over 30 years, 0.15% annual management charge. We're talking about you would keep over 30 years 95.6% of what you invested. If you just nudged it up to 0.5%, so 0.5%, doesn't sound like much either, does it? You know, 0.5% just doesn't sound like very much, but it does make a big impact. You'd only keep 86.04% of what you've invested because it's eaten away at the money you've invested. That is a huge difference. There's 10% on, you know, let's say you built up £100,000. It's a sizable amount of money. And I think that table should be a wake-up call for anyone that has, you know, money invested in anything, annual management charges that are basically too expensive. And let's see, I think there's going to be quite a bit of popularity of this SIP when it comes in January.
All right. Can I just move over to our second story, investing, following on from Woodford, talking of controversial charges. We have another fund that's locked investors in. M&G suspended trading in its $2.5 billion commercial property fund. This is after a rush out the door of its property portfolio fund's holdings. Due to Brexit uncertainty and the retail slump that's plagued the high street, apparently. Now, property funds, notoriously illiquid. M&G not able to sell off assets to meet the demands from investors for their cash. So Simon, what's going on here? Is this the start of, or is this the continuation of something that started earlier in the summer?
This is the latest chapter in a book entitled How People Never Learn Their Lesson.
That's a better way of describing it. Yep, okay.
So commercial property, property in itself, if you buy the actual properties, there are two types of commercial properties funds, some that buy the actual properties and some that hold the shares of property companies. The shares of property companies should be relatively easy to sell. You might just have to accept a lower price. Properties themselves, they take a while to sell. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that. Commercial properties can take considerably longer to sell unless you absolutely slash the price. Now, the problem with an open-ended fund is that it must grow or shrink as people put more money in or pull money out. And when people pull money out rapidly and they start to see that the market isn't doing too well and it becomes a vicious circle, the fund manager has to try and sell some assets in order to pay them back. Now, the problem is, if you are not holding assets that are easy to sell, then it can be quite difficult to start paying those people back or continue paying those people back, especially once you reach a critical point. That was where Mr. Woodford came unstuck earlier this year because he was holding a large number of small stock market listed and non-stock market listed companies. And that is where the giant M&G property fund has also come unstuck because, as you might suspect, it holds a large number of properties. People are pulling money out of commercial property funds because they see that the retail sector... So commercial property funds tend to invest in two main things, offices and retail space. Now, both of those things are doing quite badly at the moment. There are Brexit concerns over offices. Will companies require less space? Do companies just require less space anyway? There's a lot more working from home. Companies are being quite clever about cutting down on this, hot desking, all that kind of thing. The gig economy, all of those other like major factors combined with the Brexit. Let's not open our new office in London. Let's open it in Frankfurt or Hong Kong. Maybe not Hong Kong at the moment. Then combined with retail, you know, lots of retailers are going bust, which means that their landlords aren't getting their money, or they're seeking to renegotiate their rents, or when their rents come up for renewal, they're paying lower prices. There are less retailers around. There are less big retailers around that use up lots and lots of space. They're trying to be a bit more savvy with their space. So you can see where the pressure's coming from. And the chapter marked People Never Learn, in the book marked People Never Learn Their Lesson, comes from the fact that this is no surprise whatsoever, because lots of property funds had to shut the doors after the Brexit vote due to exactly the same reason. But that wasn't a surprise either, because lots of property funds had to shut their doors after the financial crisis for exactly the same reason, which then brings you back to the question of, if you are going to be concerned about this type of thing, And in fact, even if you're not worried about the fact that you can't get at your money, why you would invest in commercial property, directly in commercial property, through an open-ended fund is something of a mystery to me and lots of people who deal with investing, because what you're better off doing is investing through an investment trust, which does not have to rise, grow or shrink in line with the amount of money coming in. It has a fixed number of shares. It can go to a premium or it can fall to a discount, but it will never be a forced seller or a forced buyer. And yes, you might have to sell out at a big discount, but you won't get locked in. It's just a much better way of holding illiquid assets. So that this has happened, no great surprise. That it's happened now, maybe a slight surprise. But as I said, there has been a lot of money being pulled out. It's not like there aren't plenty of statistics that you could look at and go, there's a hell of a lot of money coming out of UK commercial property funds.
And if it happens again, will it be not much of a surprise?
Look, after the Woodford thing, there's been a lot of talk about whether there should be some form of crackdown, watchdog look, investigation, review, etc., of the fact that you have open-ended funds holding illiquid assets. If that ever rolls along, I would imagine that we are going to come to a scenario where somebody scratches their head and goes, I don't think these open-ended funds are great for holding direct commercial property. Maybe we should stop this happening.
Sam, you know how it works. It takes about sort of 6 months to a year for them to decide they're going to do a review, and then it's probably about 8 months, and then another 10 months, and then they might exactly send out a press release saying, do you know what? Perhaps those financial journalists were right.
Yeah, so I would advocate not waiting for the FCA to do something. And if you want to invest in commercial property, if you think now, when people are pulling all their money out, is actually a good opportunity, be greedy when others are fearful and all of that kind of stuff, and you're expecting a Brexit bounce, a Boris bounce, and any other word that begins with B bounce, then, and you do want to invest some money, do it through an investment trust. Don't do it through an open-ended fund.
Lee and I have got the same mind here. Lee, we're gonna move on, but we're going to stick with property. And I come to you, Lee, because you mentioned there about the rich getting richer and art collections and all this. Well, you've got an email from a reader who has a rather expensive stamp collection. Who knew? £25,000 worth of stamp collection, and they want to leave. They want to gift it to their adult son before they die. Right, so this is an issue of, I guess, inheritance tax. Do I have to give him a formal dated letter to prove it was a gift and when the gift was made? Can you suggest a format for the letter?
Well, yes, stamp collecting could be quite cool, Georgie. Just like
I'm not saying it's not. I just £25,000. You know?
I've got a nice stamp collection.
Do you? Yeah. Yeah. Stamp, is it worth
£25,000? It's not worth £25,000.
You had it valued though, didn't you?
I did have it valued. Yeah, it was closing in on a grand, but it's not
right.
Quite £25,000.
Ooh, that's really
rare,
good.
Rare stamps from the Pitcairn Islands that my father decided once upon a time to collect for some strange unknown reason, and then gave me realms and realms and massive books of them, which now live in my loft. In some dustproof jacketing, I may add. They're nicely tidied, tucked away in the attic, cash in the attic, as
yep,
they say, Georgie.
Absolutely.
In answer to this question, in a really simple explanation and thing to say about this is, it is a good idea to say a letter, you know, dated, this is when I have given so-and-so, you know, whatever it is, whatever kind of collectible it may be. Because of the inheritance tax rules, you know, we have the 7 year rule. So if you don't pass away in those 7 years, you know, nothing happens anyway. And then if you do, it will just be included into your estate, essentially. And that is, I think, the cusp and the answer to the simple answer to the question. But there might be more to it than that.
Yeah. Well, I think the really important part of this question is the do I have to prove it element. And this is something that I think is a read across to those of us who don't have £25,000 stamp collections. But there's an awful lot of people giving money to their children, to their adult children, with the idea that they would like it to fall outside of their estate if they live for another 7 years, money or assets, etc. And whilst you do not have to write a letter confirming that you are giving that money away, it's not a bad idea to do so and to keep detailed records, because what will happen eventually when you die, one day we all will, is that your executors will have to go through all of this stuff. And any proof that they have got that you gave this money away and it was more than 7 years ago, or even within the 7 years, because there's actually a taper, which the longer that passes, the less the tax bill is going to be extremely useful, both when it comes to filling out the probate forms and also if it comes to the tax man deciding to challenge it and say, well, I don't believe that they really did give you that stamp collection. I think you're just saying they gave you that stamp collection, that £10,000, that £20,000, that bit where they helped you buy a new car. It's slightly different if they give you money to directly buy a property, because quite often mortgage lenders will require you to have a letter of sort of liability signed saying that the person won't demand that money back. So there is evidence. But say, for example, you gave someone some money and then they've had it in their bank account for years and then they use it to buy a house and so on. It's quite difficult to prove that. So a signed letter is probably a good... It's not going to hurt. And it's not going to take long for you. It's literally a piece of paper, your name, your address, signed at the bottom. That's enough.
Sounds simple enough. One final story, Lee, sticking with our wealth theme. Well, I lied at the start. You can actually get rich quick. You could win on the premium bonds, Lee. But you've been doing some number crunching. How much do winners on average... I say have to hold. They don't have to hold, but they're working out the average that winners who hold the NS&I product have.
Premium bonds are an immensely popular product, Georgie. A lot of people hold them. A lot of people have very impassioned views of premium bonds and their holdings. And there's a lot of myth-busting that we do on This Is Money and a lot of number crunching because it's such a popular product. And people like that idea of being involved in a monthly lottery-style draw in which they can get their money back from. So what I was interested in this, so we had the latest set of winners on the 1st of December after the draw was made. And there's always these kind of, you know, people that say, oh, I've held premium bonds for 50 years and I haven't won anything. And, we get all sorts of questions asked. And what I was interested in, who were the 24 winners over the last year? There's two monthly prizes of £1 million. And how much do... You could hold, you know, 25 quid's worth, and you could win. But there has been, I feel, in the last year, a massive rise in gifting of premium bonds. So I'm talking about small amounts, £100, £200, because they've made it easier for grandparents and relatives and friends of friends to basically gift premium bonds. And they make quite a good present for tricky to buy, especially youngsters' birthdays, Christmases, when...
Didn't they make it also, though, at the same time, harder to win?
Well, it's not that it's harder to win. It's just that there's more people holding premium bonds. So, you know, the odds increase with the more people, obviously, that are involved in the draw. So the chances of any one bond winning is 40.33 billion to one. Far higher than the lottery.
Wow.
But of course, with the lottery, you don't get your stake back. When you can just keep your money in it. So a couple of years ago, they changed the level of money that you could hold in it from £30,000 to £40,000 to £50,000. So people can now hold £50,000 in it. And what I was interested in is that every time I see the tables who's won, it tends to be people that have quite big holdings. Of course, that makes sense because they have more numbers in the draw. But just exactly how much, that's what we were interested in. So we looked at the 24 winners. We divided how much they held in order to win the £1 million prize, and it's just shy of £36,000. So there have been in the last year two winners that have won with relatively small amounts. We've had one winner that won with £4,000, and we had another that won with £4,210. But a large chunk, seven of them, won with the maximum £50,000 in holdings. So it does show you, you know, that. Of course, the more you hold, the lower odds are. So if you hold £50,000, your odds actually go down to 1 in 835,000. If you've got £36,000 in, which we just mentioned there, it's about 1 in 1.2 million. You've got 10 grand, you've got a 1 in 4.2 million chance, and so on and so forth. That's of winning £1 million in any given month, right? So we just wanted to highlight that the chances of you winning £1 million with £100 is probably slimmer than slim when you consider how many people have a lot of money in there. And actually, we even crunched further than that. We had a look. There's this whole thing, as I said earlier, about people saying, oh, you know, older bond numbers don't win. Mm-hmm. You know, it's only newer numbers. And what we actually worked out earlier in the year, our reporter George Nixon had a look at this. And in the first third of 2019, 79% of premium bond prizes of £10,000 or more were awarded to numbers of bonds bought since the turn of the decade. So since 2010. So basically, 4 in 5 prizes of £10,000 or more have been won by people that have bought bonds since 2010. However, NS&I actually told us that it's simply because 76.7% of all premium bonds have been purchased between 2010 and 2019. 3/4 of premium bonds. That is how
the
popularity
then?
Of premium bonds has grown in the last decade.
You can hold much more and appalling savings rates.
Exactly. And people like the idea of winning that prize. And that's the thing.
I'm not saying anything here, but when was the time that we had a partnership with NS&I? You know, I think maybe it could have been related to this to this podcast. I could be wrong.
I would argue, Georgie, it was probably more the fact that you can put an extra £20,000 in them and people going, well, it's quite a safe place to put my money, or don't want to put my money in the high street bank.
Don't
Sorry, Georgie, maybe a small fraction, maybe, you know, one in 40 billion.
Yeah, I think what I like about that, what I like about this bit of number crunching that was inspired by Mr. Boyce next to me, who came up with the idea, is that it didn't show that actually they all held the absolute maximum.
No.
That it shows that maths works, because the average was a very high amount, but not perfectly in a game of chance, which, to go back to previous conversations, makes me think that one day that lottery win, it could be me.
I'm not
wasting all of that money on that direct debit. I tell you what, though, the thing about premium bond winners is they're always anonymous. They never go public. I can't remember one that went public.
£1 million isn't a lot of money now, though.
No, but if you listen to this podcast and you've won £1 million on the premium bonds, or even if you've won £500,000 or something like that, get in touch, email us. We will maintain your anonymity, but we want to hear from you, and we want to hear what it's really like to win the premium bonds.
Yeah.
All right.
Get in touch.
That sounds a bit creepy, Lee.
Get in touch with us.
Yeah, I'm not sure I want to. All I can say, though, Simon, is if you do one day win the lottery, you're not going to be here to tell us about it, I'm confident. Would you? Would you do that? Would you come in and you'd have a chat with us? Or would you just go, no, sod off, I'm in the... wherever you'd go.
Of course I would.
It's a pleasure to give me 10%. And I put that on podcast record if Simon ever wins the lottery.
I'd have to work out my notice.
Yeah, that's so decent of you, Simon. That's so decent.
Maybe I wouldn't leave.
So, no, you would, let's be honest. So if you have won a premium bond, if you have won £1 million on anything, that would be quite entertaining. But you're specifically wanting the premium bonds, right?
I'll take £1 million winner of anything.
All right, great.
Okay.
Do get in contact with us, or any questions that you have, anything you want us to investigate, Simon?
Email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, but you probably won't want to do that if you won £1 million. Or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast and join in the debate in the comments.
Or you can slide into our DMs, which would probably make a uptick on the ones I've had recently. So... I'm not going to lie.
Okay, just to be clear.
I'm glad
you said that, because I promise I am never going to use the phrase, you can slide into my DMs. When you say slide into my DMs, I'm thinking, I don't know where my DMs are.
I did
have a pair when I was a teenager that I painted, you know, with Red Hot Chili Peppers and stuff on the side. Yeah, Tipp-Ex, then coloured in and stuff. But I think they're long gone. I think it's too late for someone to slide into them.
You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.